Potential, Not Pathology, embracing creative and resourceful approaches to psychotherapy with author and therapist, Dr. Paul J. Leslie.
Welcome to Potential, Not Pathology, where we offer information and inspiration for mental health therapists who are interested in learning and applying unique therapeutic techniques and concepts into their work. With a focus on the potential each client brings to his or her therapy session, this program examines ideas and tools which can assist your clients on their journey toward healing. In this episode, we get to spend a little bit of time with a very dear friend of mine, Dana Rideout. Dana is a psychotherapist, yoga instructor, corporate consultant, and entrepreneur. She works with individuals and groups, and I think she is a fantastic human being and psychotherapist. Dana's done a lot of work working in the field of trauma and working primarily with first responders, utilizing such useful strategies as mindfulness, yoga, and other assorted things that help with emotional regulation. Her goal is to help people find those missing neurological pieces that can help them have a happier, safer, and more productive personal interactions. In our interview today, Dan and I talk a lot about her work, how she came to find her way on the path of becoming not just a therapist, but working with first responders. She talks about the different comfort levels that we bring into therapy, how to use things like yoga for anxiety, how sometimes making sense of a certain intervention or application might not be the primary motive. There needs to be a balance of knowing and not knowing on part of both therapist and client. And above all, she brings her heart and her soul, which I love so much. She's been a dear friend to me, and I'm sure you're going to fall in love with her. And I hope you enjoy this interview. All right. Dana Rideout, welcome to Potential Not Pathology.
Hello, hello.
Thank you for being with me today and that our schedules could accommodate each other.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes. I would like you to start by telling everybody specifically what started your journey to becoming a psychotherapist.
A very wild, different, all kinds of streets kind of converging to one. But it all makes sense now. But at the time, it was quite harrowing and a little terrifying. But I guess, and certainly in junior high, high school, always, oh, you're so easy to talk to. Mm-hmm. Which led to thinking, when I got to college, I seem to be good with people, so absolutely I went to advertising public relations.
It's a logical choice.
And, I did quite well. I got my bachelor's in journalism there at a University of Arkansas, Fayetteville, and got a couple of awards, did great. And so, of course, then I'm off and running and got into, started working for an advertising firm. And then it all came to a crash because, and what I know now that I didn't know then was in college, it was about meeting your audience where they were and pulling out their potential, showing the potential of your product, or usually in college, it was the service that we were trying to sell. And getting those two mindsets to converge and that skill, all of the marketing and the writing and everything. But when I actually had to do it for a company that was maybe their outcomes and their expectations, like pulling in more bank accounts, making more profit on chicken products, and even the fundraisers where they were, raising for things that maybe I didn't quite believe in or think was important, my creativity just tanked. So still thinking about people skills, or my people skills, So then I went into teaching, and I taught special needs, deaf and hard of hearing, for many years, and enjoyed that. But again, within the confines of the classroom, though, and public education, and what was what they wanted, and the really the limited amount of time you got to really know your kids, it still was not quite my niche. And one of my high school kids was teaching at the North Carolina School for the Deaf. Prior to that, I got my master's actually teaching the deaf and hard of hearing. And one of my high school students said to me, I stayed after class one day and we were really talking, of course, through sign. And he said, you know, Miss Morgan, my maiden name. He said, you know, Miss Morgan. He said, you'd make a great counselor someday. Mm-hmm. And I had already been thinking about moving to something else that really grabbed my stomach. Mm-hmm. And he said that. And, you know, I don't know. It just, my universe just exploded. Mm-hmm. You know, was it a sign? Mm-hmm. Was it the hand of God? Was it, I don't know. But I just know my brain exploded. And so from there, so then I got my master's in counseling from Western Carolina University, and haven't looked back.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned how you have all these diverging roads and, you know, all these kind of things, and it reminded me of the philosopher Schopenhauer talked about that these things that don't seem to make any sense to us, you know, at the end of our life, we look back and it's like some great author had taken
some great author, yeah.
And then written this wonderful novel.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that kind of is how it felt for you.
It absolutely is, because what it all entails, as you know, is, you know, I have these, what I feel to be strong writing skills, journalism mm-hmm. skills, mm-hmm. because that's what I was trained in my bachelor's degree. And then certainly the public relations, the advertising, marketing, you know, being able to meet the needs of different audiences and how to communicate that. Getting in front of all of my students, particularly at the schools for the deaf, the education levels, even though they're in the 8th grade or 9th grade, I guess this is true for any public education class, but everyone is such a different learner. Mm-hmm. And developmentally, they're all on different levels. And being able to keep all of those people engaged mm-hmm. Lent that kind of skill really came through when I started working as a therapist at our psychiatric hospital here, and running groups on the inpatient units and then certainly in our outpatient units. And I think it was at that moment one of my interns mentioned, you know, how nervous she was, and was I nervous coming into a group for the first time? And, you know, I could say that actually, you know, there's a little trepidation, but no, because I had been doing it for so long, mm-hmm. But just in a different environment. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned about like different learners and how everyone kind of brings their own way of being engaged in something. When you're working with either a group or an individual client, how do you work to make sure that their specific style of being in the world is met? Because, you know, a lot of times therapists have this idea that if I just get the next technique, if I just learn the next theory, you know, the client will magically mold to that theory, which has worked for me absolutely none of the time, because I've decided to be human and, you know, throw a monkey wrench in that. How do you kind of have to, through your experience as a therapist and even before, what are some things that you've kind of learned on how to meet the people where they are?
I think that also, that didn't come from a textbook mm-hmm. either. Mm-hmm. I really credit my upbringing for that. And I can tell you from a more academic standpoint, though, a lot of the work that I share with companies or groups that I'm meeting with about different kinds of communication and how to help people regulate emotions, either individually or as a group, comes from Dr. Ruby Payne. And she, Dr. Payne, talks about the language of poverty She, or just understanding poverty and then the different languages, the particularly, you know, the casual register and the formal register used in general by different socioeconomic groups. Well, I come from those socioeconomic groups. I've interacted closely with two primarily, and that being certainly poor, working poor, and then the middle class. I know people that are wealthy. I'm not one of them, but I can hold my own in those groups as well. But it's that language, and it's understanding that language, that register, the different stories that come, how important story is in each of those economic groups. And does that make sense? I guess what I'm saying, So, my grandparents, my maternal grandparents were absolutely, they were the Depression folks, and so they grew up in the mountains of Northwest Arkansas, and migrated during the Depression. You know, did everything, picking cotton. You know, made clothes out of burlap sacks. I still have my grandfather's chest that they put on their Model T, and they drove across the country to the west and picked oranges. And so, no more than a sixth grade education, and most of my relatives on that side of my family, they didn't have a higher education. Of course, the smartest people ever. I mean, incredibly resourceful. But a different language, so I grew up with that, but then also grew up with parents that were very education minded, and was fortunate to be in a family that wanted me to be educated, and unfortunately I was called to education. I did well in school. So that certainly opened some doors and helped with some ways to communicate. Again, but very middle class. And where I grew up was in the San Joaquin Valley of California, and it was a very diverse middle class community. So I got to meet with Portuguese families and African American. One of my best friends was African American, and then another friend of mine was from Mexico, and it was a magnificent upbringing. Later on in adolescence, it wasn't quite so smooth. I moved quite a bit, which again means that I had to. And when I say moved, I mean we moved from the Midwest to the South to Texas to back to Arkansas, and each time our own socioeconomic status had changed, usually for the worse. So, but sometimes for the better, and just having to adjust and to accommodate. And so I just gathered, I guess what I was doing, I didn't know it at the time, but I was just gathering ways to survive. And for me, that was through communication and interpersonal skills and strategies. So that in particular has really carried over, I think, into my practice, where a client sits in front of me or there's a group of folks. It's not too often that I meet somebody where I don't have some pretty genuine, more than empathy, I mean, just some more kind of genuine connection that I can see there's some kind of something that we have in common that I can start from and pull from. And the other thing, too, to answer your question is regular old curiosity.
Yes.
I'm just so curious. That doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to like everybody. I don't like all of my clients. But I do really like a grand portion of them. And I'm sure they don't all like me, but that's not what this business is about. But am I curious about them? Oh, yeah, absolutely, hands down, every single one of them. And that curiosity, again, I didn't know what it was growing up and what I was doing, what I was growing, but I do now, thanks to being led to this profession and that high school student said you should be a counselor. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I'm incredibly curious. Yeah.
You know, that seems to be one of the most consistent attributes of all the people I've talked to. And as you know, I know a lot of people, and I've been fortunate to have so many great friends who are just superb therapists. And curiosity seems to be one of the biggest attributes that I find in common with them. Obviously, empathy. The third one is I find that a lot of the really, really great therapists are willing to kind of push their comfort zone a little mm-hmm. bit. How do you kind of approach your comfort zone?
With my heels dug in. We don't like change, yeah, no. Dr. Paul Leslie. I talk about it all day long, but I don't like it. Oh, my comfort zone. Yeah, well, you know, So, my comfort zone, I'm taking on more as a dance partner these days than something that I'm fighting with. And to me, quite honestly, that's just kind of an age thing, too. Mm-hmm. I just get tired of fighting with them.
Turning 30 is very difficult.
Turning 30 is very difficult, yeah.
I haven't reached there yet, but your age and wisdom is helping me. Thank you.
But yeah. However, the true story is 50 has just been has been tremendous, and I'm sad that I waited until 50. I don't know why that was so magical, but but the comfort zone, you know. Here's the answer to that. Okay, mm-hmm. I figured it out. The comfort zone thing is. The guilt I feel if I don't explore my comfort zone. You know, I'm an oldest child, mm-hmm. so I come by my guilt. Honestly, thank you, Mom. And so, she's great. But I do feel a tremendous sense of obligation to explore my own comfort zone and expand it if I'm going to continue to be an effective therapist. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just doing your work, right? Mm-hmm. And if I'm asking my clients to do that, then again, I've got to be able to do that too. Mm-hmm. And you know, the truly lovely thing about being willing to look into your comfort zone and expand it. In fact, that's interesting you talk about that, because just this morning I was looking at some meditations I might do for my yoga class tomorrow, and I came across, I won't be able to say it well at all, but I came across the blue dragon in the cave. Are you familiar with that? Mm-hmm. The blue dragon in the cave, and he's protecting this cave, and he was talking about this is, but it's fear. It's a metaphor mm-hmm. for fear. Yeah. And I believe it's a Buddhist, it's only like four lines, but it's basically, you know, you delve into the cave with the blue dragon, mm-hmm. And it's there that you see the forest full of patterns, mm-hmm. and then beyond that is where the pearl is. So I don't know what I'm going to do with that yet, but I know that really spoke to me. It's rich, and mm-hmm. that's pushing your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. That's also, to me, though, if I'm going to explore a cave, I want guides. I know that they can't enter into that cave with me, but I want people around me who've explored their own caves and mm-hmm. have had to deal with their own blue dragons. And so that's why, you know, incredible friendships and mentorships like with you and with Courtney Armstrong and all the different people that I've met and or invited to almost begged, will you please help me with this, because this is what I want to do. To me, maybe it's because I'm an extrovert, but I think it's a healthy way to do it too, is I need my team. I need a mm-hmm. team that coaxes me and does. And of course, in here again, I mean, you've done it. You've been magnificent in helping me with stuff like that. Just, you know, ask if I'm like, I don't know about that. And you just kind of look at me with this on, like, why not? Mm-hmm. And it's very genuine. It's, you know, it's not like you're kind of being my cheerleader. It really is just kind of the sense of, huh, why not? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's important if you're when you're exploring your comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
If you're going to take that on. And, mm-hmm. and I choose to. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, well, I don't want to. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to because I owe that to my clients.
Mm-hmm. You know, you said, just briefly, you said about, you know, when you turn 50, so many of the things, why you waited till 50, it's interesting. The Japanese have a saying that life begins at 50. My great-grandmother said, you don't have any sense until you're 40. I think she made 50, she was off by 10 years. She's someone who's not quite, getting closer to 50, but I still don't know. But and it sounds like maybe you needed these experiences leading up to 50 to be able to push your comfort zone even further. You probably couldn't have done this 10 years ago.
Absolutely. No, there's no way. And again, my kind of tipping my hat to Courtney Armstrong, mm-hmm. because she doesn't, you know, I adore her, and I don't want to make her uncomfortable by how much I adore her, but
okay.
I love her work.
I'll shut you off if you get to go.
She has just been huge. And, again, I've only met her personally a couple of times, but I know at one level, knowing that Courtney, I don't think she would mind me saying this at all, but I know she's a couple of years actually younger than I am. Mm-hmm.
She wouldn't mind you saying that at all.
Not
times.
At all. So she, her work, and then of course just her as a person anyway,
right.
What a rich, neat soul she has. But absolutely, I have had times, you know, my good old ego, like, oh, mm-hmm. I should be. Then I've been then because she's younger than I am. I'm older than she is. Why didn't I think about doing this and this and this? And what, mm-hmm. And I need to be ahead in my game and doing this and speaking to a wider audience. And, you know, look at all that Courtney's accomplished. And, mm-hmm. I've gotten caught up in that self-talk, and certainly, it wasn't anything Courtney did or didn't do. It was because her work spoke to me so mm-hmm. much, mm-hmm. and her sense of humor and her approach and the way she, what I glean, the way she, works with her clients has been very similar to things that I do,
right.
Especially the use of sense of humor. So I thought, oh man, how did I miss that? Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, obviously, truth be known, if I, there's no way I could have gotten there. We were, mm-hmm. Courtney and I were on very different paths growing up. And, I'm very satisfied with where I am. And like I said, everything now, mm-hmm. looking back, makes absolute sense.
Mm-hmm.
And as my high school kids used to say, age ain't nothing but a number.
Yeah.
It's just a number. So, but again, my special shout out to Courtney for...
Yeah.
For being doing such great work and taking the time and the care.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that you both have in common is an interest in working with people who have been through trauma. And of course, it's hard not to have that interest if you're going to be in our field. But specifically, kind of the relational aspect of trauma, how we deal with trauma. Sometimes someone who's, I need to work on myself, I've been through this traumatic event, so they need to have some resources to be able to work with their trauma. But also sometimes they're in relationships, they work, and these kind of things. I think of the world in systemic terms, so there's, not just an isolation somebody with trauma. As I'm saying this, I'm reminded of Timothy Leary had this great quote that said, the most dysfunctional person in any group controls the dynamics of the group. And I think that's really true.
That's very true.
So can you talk a little bit about your work with trauma? And also, I'd like for you to talk a little bit specifically about the work you do with first responders, police, firefighters, etc., EMTs. Because that's a special niche that unfortunately still, is not filled enough as it should.
The, the work that I do with trauma, really, I didn't set out to specialize in that, but certainly the years of counseling and then working as an inpatient therapist with our psychiatric hospital here in town, it became clear pretty quick that no matter who I was talking to, there was some form of trauma, whether or not it would be something either that you and I would actually define as trauma. That wasn't the point. Mm-hmm. The point was how they perceived an event or a series of events. It 9 times out of 10 came down to something traumatic. And then later with that, when I started to become more, I was fortunate enough, and I'm not going to be able to remember his last name, but out of Greer, South Carolina, the family trauma center in Greer, I believe that's the name of it. But I took a workshop there, and the gentleman that owned that group, that building, Chris, and I'm not going to be able to remember his last name right off the top of my head, but he introduced me to Bessel van der Kolk. Mm-hmm. He introduced, and I already knew about Peter Levine, and mm-hmm. I actually came upon Courtney's work later on, but when I got to see through Chris's workshops, and I think at the time he was also kind of emphasizing neuro-linguistic programming too, mm-hmm. and when I got to see how quickly mm-hmm. we could actually resolve some of these issues, like even in one session, I was blown away, mm-hmm. blown away. And then that was when I really started delving more into neurologically what was happening, allowing myself to be something I had never been before, which was more of a scientist, or what I guess I've always been. If I'm curious, I've always been kind of scientific in my inquiry, but never really saw myself as a scientist or... And I just allowed myself to do that and mm-hmm. to think of myself like that. So really studying the brain more and studying the different parts and how they're impacted by fear mm-hmm. And how things can get out of whack. So with that said, then learning some of these techniques, again, Peter Levine's and what Courtney's used and reading Bessel van der Kolk, led me down to, I knew that I really, for my own ADD brain, needed a niche, and this felt like, in a mm-hmm. weird way, this felt like home. And as I've shared with you before, I mean, I've had trauma and mm-hmm. unfortunately lost my father when I was 19 to suicide, and so there's been a long enough period of time where I could really kind of delve into that and not bring up a bunch of stuff, but I could look back at some of the pain and figure out how that impacted me and the family, and then apply it to my work with clients, mm-hmm. and then ultimately now with larger groups. I knew once I got into trauma, I knew that at some point, and I didn't know quite how it was going to work, but that I wanted to do something more with law enforcement. And it's a no-brainer because my dad was a cop. And one of his dear friends who actually helped us right in the thick of things, her name was Nancy Bond. And she was a psychologist mm-hmm. who worked with my father at the Grandview Police Department where he was chief of police. And I always thought that was so cool because I wanted to be a cop. I'm afraid of the dark.
Yeah, okay.
I'm afraid of the dark. That's all problematic. So I did want to be a cop. So when I met Nancy, I remember this vividly. And I guess that probably goes back to my journey, too. When I met Nancy, she was just so rockin' cool, and mm-hmm. unlike anybody I'd ever met. And I met her when I was... probably 11, 12, mm-hmm. 13, something like that. And I thought, now that's something I could do.
Yeah.
I could talk to police about mm-hmm. their problems, mm-hmm. not really understanding that police really don't like to talk about mm-hmm. their problems, yeah. which is understandable. So I finally the opportunity came, and also it came at a time when I had also been studying yoga more in depth. I've always had my own yoga practice, my own personal practice, that kind of waxed and waned, but I was studying to be a yoga teacher, and then got introduced to the science of yoga, mm-hmm. William Broad, and he goes into the, again, more of the neurological impact of the yoga moves, and separates myth and fact. So it all kind of came to this glorious little moment where I got asked to do a lunch and learn mm-hmm. for our public safety folks here, and apparently it went well. And so now I work with the first responders in introducing mindfulness techniques, some yoga postures and stretches, as well as, again, talking to them about the brain mm-hmm. and how our brains react to certain communication in certain situations, theirs and the folks that they deal with every single day. Mm-hmm. And ways to regulate their emotions. And it was our chief here in Aiken that introduced me to Dr. Gilmartin, Kevin Gilmartin, and the emotional survival for law enforcement. And so I utilize his work in my presentations and am getting geared up, fingers crossed, to head out to Bend, Oregon in November. Mm-hmm. And take a three-day retreat with Richard Yearling, with the Mindful Badge folks, mindfulbadge.com. Mm-hmm. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm. Now, just you mentioned yoga. I wanted to go back to that. And I also know that you teach a specific class for people who suffer with anxiety and anxiety disorders. Could you just briefly mention the way I kind of think about from talking to you previously is like you're giving folks kind of inner resources outside of the yoga room to kind of deal with anxiety in a way that's not strictly just, okay, now I need to go into Down Dog here in the middle of Walmart, you know, because something's, you know, triggered me. Can you talk about how you know, what kind of things you teach and how you teach those kind of things, what's important about that?
So first and foremost, it is a great energy class. I mean, the people that come to this are so diverse in their age and their background and educational level, and that's what I hoped for, and that's mm-hmm. what's happening. Mm-hmm. In the class, the sequence that I have developed for that class in order to help them manage their mood is I pull from some work, Courtney Armstrong's work, mm-hmm. As well as Amy Weintraub with Life Force Yoga, mm-hmm. and what it boils down to is it's a regular 60-minute class, although I kind of take them a little bit longer, but we actually do about 3-5 minutes of some low-impact moves, whether it's dancing, whether it's jogging in place, it's jumping jacks, but to get them out of their fight or flight, to let the body go ahead and express it, mm-hmm. express that anxiety, like Dr. Sapolsky tells us mm-hmm. in Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. You know, they don't get ulcers because they shake off those stress hormones, and we do the exact opposite of what we're supposed to do. We got to keep real chill, real still, be, you know, in control, don't mm-hmm. let anybody see you sweat, kind of thing. And so that's counter, that's counterintuitive to what the body really wants to do. So we go ahead and right off the bat, before we try to do any kind of postures and certainly before any kind of meditation, we go ahead and let the body move. We get that heart rate up to a low aerobic level. Then we filter through the postures, and the postures move. We do quite a bit with the chair, but to be clear, it's not so much, you know, chair yoga, or mm-hmm. and it's not really that gentle, quite honestly. I mean, we do build a sweat and get sore, But it's showing them what they can do in the moment. As you said, that where maybe they can't do a down dog, but if they've got a chair handy, there are some things, ways that they can use that chair as a prop. If they're with the computer all day, if they're interviewing people all day, if they're, you know, sitting in their car, even whatever, showing them how they can breathe and move with the car. And I do a little extra explanation each pose that we go into, or almost each pose that we go into, why it's indicated for anxiety or why it's indicated for depression. The meditation at the end, or instead of the corpse pose for the 4 minutes, or just the relaxation, it's actually more of the yogic sleep. It's the yoga nidra. And so they stay alert, they stay aware, but it's a little bit longer. And just let their, sometimes I guide it, sometimes the music guides it, and there's usually some silence there too. It's going pretty well. So it's a little bit of a different yoga class than what you would normally see, but by the same token, I also use that and encourage the students that come to that class to venture out into other yoga classes and let them know these are the poses you really want to focus on. You know, bridge is one, legs up the wall, shoulder stand, so that when you go to these other classes, boy, when you get into these poses, those are going to be the ones you're going to love for your anxiety. When you start getting into the child's pose, or poses where your face is closer to your chest or you're closer to the wall, you know, don't freak out if you get a little claustrophobic. That's just kind of a part of it. But, you know, and showing them how they can back out of it. But it's been really cool. And then in the other part of it too is that, you know, most, let me see here for a second, but yeah, the vast majority of the folks that go to that class don't have any yoga experience at all, or just very little. And since I know you have experience with yoga too, it's really amazing how in a short amount of time just the body feels stronger. And so I remind them too, this isn't all going to make sense. It's not supposed to all make sense. But the first time, the first time you almost fall and you catch yourself, or the first time that you're able to reach for something and it doesn't hurt, you've just helped your anxiety level. So that's absolutely, I've had many folks coming up and talking about that, and it just really kind of blew them away after about 3 sessions, where they just, feeling that the spine was stronger, feeling that the muscles were more fluid, helped their anxiety, or helped them through a depressive episode. And so it's pretty cool.
Those natural resources that they have to pull from.
Well, and that they had all along.
All along.
Like we all do.
Yes. You mentioned saying to them, this might not make sense, and this probably won't make sense. It's just making me wonder, there's this quest in our field in therapy for us to make people understand things. And I have found that understanding by itself rarely changes anything. So when you're working with somebody, whether it's in your, you know, individual or group work, corporate work, whatever, how do you bridge that between, well, I understand that, but I need to embody that?
Oh, wow. Because that takes a lot of faith, doesn't it? Faith in the process on my part, but definitely their part too.
Oh, yeah.
I would say, you know, there is, more often than not, being in front of a client, being in front of a group of people, this definitely plays into the work that I do with the corporate folks at this point, because this is really such new information for the folks that I'm working with on that end. I mean, very educated people, but just this, just the information is new. They demonstrate a certain form of understanding or a confidence at some point, that I get to reflect back, that I get to show them. It just in their talking with, mm-hmm. with me, or they're talking, if it's a group, what, the way that they talk with each other, my only job is to stay keen on it, to really keep my eyes open for it. So if there is an interaction between, let's say it is in my corporate group, and they have, and this has absolutely happened, you know, they, you know, third class, and they're still intrigued by this whole notion of how to, you know, emotional regulation and mindfulness, and how the breathing can help us to keep our amygdala from hijacking the brain, and mm-hmm. how we can help our employees calm their amygdalas down, or their Amy's, as we call it, and click into their wise mind. Thank you, Marshall Linehan. But mm-hmm. how to click into their wise mind, and they're intrigued, but they don't understand it, mm-hmm. and something will happen, I got to practice this a little bit more in our last class, where there will be an interaction between the two of them. And I'll say, oh, you just did it. You mm-hmm. just helped that person. Mm-hmm. You just helped. Did you see what you just did? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, then the light bulb goes off. You mean that was what the, mm-hmm. you know, that was what you were talking about? And the way that I worded it right then was, mm-hmm. yeah, that's it. That's it. You did it. Mm-hmm. And you didn't know you could do it, but you still kept coming. Mm-hmm. So I, instead of really kind of celebrating that outcome, I talked to them about, so why did you keep coming to this class? If you didn't really understand why you were coming, why did you keep coming? And so we talk about that more. And then they see the worth of curiosity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they see the worth of the curiosity. It's for me, that's why I love groups and working with larger mm-hmm. groups of folks. Because when you get that interaction between them, not just me and one person, but between them, and then I can just kind of really be the observer. Mm-hmm. That's pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Did that make sense? Yeah. Did I get too ethereal way out there? Yeah. I get to show them how important it is to stay curious, to stay open, to stay faithful in their seeking, mm-hmm. and how far that's gotten them. Rather than you did it, congratulations.
So what I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, is there is this the experience is going to trump any kind of logical understanding, because we can all logically understand. Reminds me of the joke about the guy who was in psychoanalysis for 10 years, and they ask him, well, how's that going? He says, I don't feel any better, but I understand a whole hell of a lot more. You know? So it's the experience of when they actually do it, and the experience of being curious, and the experience of being, it's okay that I don't know where this is going.
Yeah.
Which is this also called life, because none of us know. Is that active experience is what you're cultivating in your work. Not just in corporations, not just with first responders, but also down to just your individual client is, you know, facilitating that it's okay to sit in the experience of not knowing.
And yet, yes to all of that. And yet, you know, the logical piece I still cling to, and I still want to know myself.
We're working on you.
Yeah, thank you. But the logical stuff, well, to me, that's where understanding more of how that organ up in our skull works. Mm-hmm. Because if I can understand more how the brain processes fear, mm-hmm. then for me, then that helps me to have more confidence, more faith in the process of not, or just in not knowing. I know that my brain is going to be afraid, and my brain is going to be afraid and then send messages to the rest of my body to put to my adrenal glands going off and sending out stress hormones because it's doing what it's supposed to do. Mm-hmm. The brain is my understanding of the brain is it's wired to do two things and two things only: to survive and to be right. And really, quite frankly, the more that we're right, theoretically, then the more able we are to survive. So if I know that, if I know that that's what the brain is wired to do, then I really can rest, let my brain rest a little bit more in the not knowing. And that's what I try to bring to groups, especially groups that, you know, don't study this, that are not as nerdy and interested in it as I am, is, you know, they folks that I'm talking to right now, they're not so much interested in understanding more about just the universe and the not knowing and the flow of things, the prana and the chi. Mm-hmm. You know, they you know, just the facts, ma'am. Mm-hmm. So I can give them that the fluidity of the seeking and resting in that, while also telling them why that's important for their brain and for their body, making it more physical, more tangible. I hope I do that. I think I do that. They keep coming back.
Well, that's usually a good sign.
So I'm just going to kind of go with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, your business and marketing experience from way back when would probably tell you if they're coming back for the product, then you probably have a good product.
Fingers crossed, yeah, man.
Yeah. All right. Well, as we wrap up, I would like you let people know specifically how they can get in touch with you. Because I know, as we discussed, you offer a lot of different programs and you're going to be traveling more and doing more. What's the best way people can get in touch with you? And just, you know, if you want to mention some of the things you offer and will be offering in the future.
Sure. So probably the best way is through my website. And that's DanaRideOutLPC.com. So DanaRideOutLPC.com. And it's got all my contact information there. It has an email address there and a phone number there. And I will continue, there will be links to certainly the individual counseling, but also, the yoga therapy. That yoga for anxiety class, is held every Sunday here in Aiken, at Aiken Yoga, from 4 to 5. But it's a terrific studio, and so props to Aiken Yoga and Sarah and Barry Accord. It's a lovely space, and they've been great to work with. And then the other branch of me is mobile mindfulness, and that's the part of my business where I do go out on site to companies and certainly to these agencies, to work with groups of employees for anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks, and conduct these classes, sessions, meetings, whatever you want to call it, about regulating emotions, mindfulness strategies, like I said, some of the stretches, yoga postures, a lot of the material that I shared with my people in group therapy, quite frankly,
right.
And just tailoring it for folks that have never been to counseling before or have specific needs outside of something, you know, counsel-y or mental health-y. Mm-hmm. But of course, that's kind of what it is. That's what it's all about, is mental conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
And also learning not only physical flexibility, but emotional flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and upcoming events, I'm just, I'm doing my marketing thing, trying to get folks interested in mobile mindfulness and what I can do to help them with that. I'm also looking into, opportunities for, forest bathing.
Mm-hmm.
So, washing ourselves in this essential oil outside in the trees and all the cool health benefits of that. So looking into some opportunities to be able to take some small groups of people out into the trees and mm-hmm. get healthy. So, yeah, and then just, I think that's probably about it from the counseling standpoint, because otherwise my own therapy is music, mm-hmm. listening to music, yeah. some of your good music.
Oh, thank you. Well, likewise. Well, I thank you for being with me today, and this has been kind of a special treat for me, because we've been friends for such a long time, and I just admire you so much, and I've been privileged to watch you, your work, and to watch you grow, and that's been a gift.
Well, thanks a lot, Paul. Well, I can absolutely feel the same, most definitely, so I'm glad our paths crossed.
Thank you for listening to Potential Not Pathology with Dr. Paula J. Leslie. If you enjoyed the show, check out our website at potentialnotpathology.com, where you will find programs and articles showcasing unique and creative therapy.